Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the Islamic State's territory in Syria and Iraq has been reduced to a small fraction of what it was when ISIS declared its caliphate. That was back in 2014. But is the Islamic State really defeated? One of the central questions we'll ask this hour. My guest is former Air Force intelligence analyst Evan Renfro. He's now on the faculty at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls in the Department of Political Science, where he's an assistant professor. And he is joining us for the hour from our Cedar Falls studio. Evan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be with you.
It's usually a Wednesday when we have you on, our political analyst, but this is a nice way to also talk about your background, perhaps a little bit later in the program after we talk about ISIS. You were, I understand, active duty for 4 years, studied Arabic, terrorism, Middle East politics, even did research and briefed four-star generals, I understand.
That's correct. In my four-year service commitment, they were nice enough to extend without asking me for another year. This was back in 2005, if you remember, it was rather, those were fraught days.
Yes, absolutely. We'll talk perhaps a little bit on the more personal side of your career, fascinating stuff, a little bit later in the program. But let's go back, as we get your analysis on ISIS today, let's go back to the pinnacle of their power, perhaps, at least as portrayed in our media, the summer of 2014, when ISIS had made a dramatic expansion of control over areas in Iraq and Syria. At that time, there was often news of these mass executions, kidnappings. This is a bit of a report from NPR's All Things Considered from September of 2014. Here's host Arun Rat.
Today, another family is mourning the loss of a man kidnapped, held hostage, then murdered by the extremists known as the Islamic State. British aid worker David Haynes became the third hostage in a month whose apparent beheading has been filmed and released online. The militants threatened to kill a second British hostage next. NPR's Alice Fordham asks whether this could shift Western public opinion in favor of more aggressive military action.
The videos have become grimly familiar. The black-masked fighter stands in the desert wielding a knife. The hostage kneels wearing orange and, before the killing, both men make speeches condemning Western intervention against the Islamic State and calling for it to end. But some analysts say the videos may have the opposite effect, catalyzing public opinion in favor of action against the extremists. From the Center for Strategic and...
That from All Things Considered, September 2014. Here's the news you might have missed from last month, a parade in Iraq, and what host Kelly McEvers said.
Iraq is celebrating the defeat of ISIS. Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi over the weekend declared December 10th the country's newest national holiday. He presided over a huge military parade in Baghdad with troops and tanks. NPR's Jane Araf joins us from Baghdad now to talk about this and what is ahead for Iraq. Hello, Jane.
Hi, Kelly.
So when Iraq says it has defeated ISIS, what does that actually mean?
Well, it means, first of all, I guess, and most importantly, that major combat is indeed over. And we'll remember that this is the group that controlled a third of the country 3 years ago. It's now been driven out of all of the cities, Fallujah, Ramadi, Mosul, and it's been driven out of the desert where it took refuge, and crucially, those areas around the Syrian border. Mm-hmm. So apart from small pockets, it's now eradicated basically on both sides of that border. So it is truly a very big deal.
News from about a month ago on ISIS. Catch us up, Evan Renfro. Fill in the blanks there. We have 2 points that our listeners will remember, may remember in our news. It's been reduced to a small fraction of what it was in 2014. What happened to ISIS in the past few years?
Well, Ben, I can offer you a rare piece of good news nowadays. I can say that ISIS is largely eliminated from Iraq, and there's only about 3,000 active members left in a dusty outpost area of Syria. They're being quickly closed in on by U.S. and allied forces, as well as Russian and Iranian and Syrian air power from two different angles. We can talk about the complexities involved with these sorts of air operations later. Mm-hmm. But indeed, ISIS has been reduced to a mere shadow of its former self. Really, we're talking about a group that owned the area of Kentucky in its heyday and is now reduced to the size of half of Manhattan. Mm-hmm. So certainly in a strictly military sense, tactical and operational, this is a success story.
Does that mean they will never again pose a threat?
No. And sadly, terrorism will probably be with us as long as the region remains chaotic and civil society remains weak. We already see al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, primarily in Yemen, is really thriving. We had al-Qaeda reduced to rubble in the past, and they're right back at it in Yemen.
So we think this ISIS will take the Islamic State will take a similar path to when it has is it defeated on territory, it will just morph into something else.
It will morph into something else, and they'll change their tactics. They already are. They're not going to do that head-to-head military engagement anymore. That's a losing option for them. They'll go to guerrilla tactics. You'll see more IEDs, more lone wolf terror attacks. And they may, in fact, dismantle and call themselves something else down the road.
Mm-hmm. So differentiate a little bit ISIS as differentiated from al-Qaeda or even the Taliban. We've been dealing with all these groups since 9/11.
Sure. So, you know, ISIS, or Daesh as it's known in the Middle East, sort of emanated from al-Qaeda in Iraq, which manifested itself in the early days of the U.S. invasion in Iraq, where you had that power vacuum and the chaos that ensued, always a breeding ground for terrorism. And they got into a beef. The head of the now deceased head of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which created ISIS, had a beef with bin Laden. Their goals were a little different. So al-Qaeda's goal has been always to produce a caliphate someday. It will be nice to have an Islamic state governed by Sharia, but now
that's the definition of a caliphate,
right? And so their goal has always been to do that eventually, but presently we have more important things to do. We have got to attack the U.S. imperialists in the region. We have got to attack Israel, etc. Where Daesh or ISIS differs so much is they want the caliphate today, which is why they just declared themselves the Islamic State based out of Raqqa, Syria. This infuriated al-Qaeda leadership, and they had a serious break in relations. I mean, they're killing each other today still in Syria. So while their goals, you know, are similar, they're different enough to cause much discontent within the senior leadership as well as the ranks.
I don't know, in your present position or as in your work in Air Force intelligence, if you were asked to get, or to what degree did you have to understand the mindset of someone following, attracted to ISIS, who would be willing to sacrifice himself for that cause, whatever that cause is?
Right. So I think the most important thing to do is to understand what the goals are, what's the motivations. And, you know, al-Qaeda, as well as ISIS, is happy to tell you all about their goals and aspirations. Now, as far as the mindset for the rank and file, it is extremely varied. You'll have people with graduate degrees in engineering, or people that are illiterate join the ranks. You'll have rich terrorists and poor terrorists. Mm-hmm. So there's not really a profile, psychological or otherwise, that goes into these sorts of groups.
It's so far from what many of us can imagine. We'd like to just say, well, they're crazy.
Right.
But they're not, or how would you classify them?
Well, some of them are indeed crazy. And those are the ones that, you know, you sort of say, oh, well, they're crazy, and that makes you feel better. But indeed, many of them, if not most, are what we call rational actors. They, you know, Daesh actually had a sort of a 401k. They had retirement benefits for their for the ISIS personnel that would join them. They had medical care, great pay and benefits. And if you have 40% unemployment, which you have in some of these states in the Middle East, you're going to see that starts sounding pretty good for an uneducated young man with no prospects.
Mm-hmm. You said about 3,000 left, a pocket of about 3,000 under siege. How do they give themselves up? Do they tend to surrender? Do they tend to fight to the last man?
Well, a lot of them have. I think those that are going to be surrendering or fleeing have already done the fleeing and surrendering. I think what you have now left are your more hardcore elements that will probably be in there for the long haul. And the problem is they leave traps, booby traps, for the personnel when they have to clear through these areas. It's just very dangerous right down to the last man, and even after the last man falls.
Okay, to take us back to what you mentioned just a moment ago, I'll remind our listeners in the meantime, Evan Renfro is my guest this hour, former Air Force intelligence analyst now at the University of Northern Iowa, analyzing, first of all, during this hour, ISIS, the defeat of ISIS. We'll put that in quotation marks for right now. If you have any questions about ISIS, other terror groups to draw on Evan's experience and analysis, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's talk about, sort of on the ground or in the air, how ISIS was defeated. Very complicated situation with a lot of players, the United States, Russia, but we're in a part of the world where we have Iran, Sunni-dominated Iran, Shia-dominated Saudi Arabia, the whole Middle East. Tell us, in military terms, how these powers, with lots of different interests in other parts of the world, allied themselves to defeat ISIS.
Well, so, yeah, it's Shia-dominated Iran, which has a serious beef with the Sunni-backed, al-Qaeda and ISIS is Sunni as well. Saudi Arabia is, the Sunni powerhouse. So one way to analyze what's happening in the Middle East is to look at this as if it's a Cold War between Shia Iran and Sunni Saudi Arabia. These are two of the heavy hitter states. They hate each other. They are really fighting in Yemen. It is the Saudi-backed government of Yemen that has been overthrown by the Iranian-backed Shia Houthi rebels that are causing this conflict. The U.S. is, trying to stay on the sidelines. We've amped up our airstrikes in that area. We don't want Yemen to become a breeding ground for terrorism, although it already is. Mainly, we're sharing intelligence, and the policy is fully backing Saudi Arabia. So there's no question about we definitely have picked a side when it comes to Yemen. But as far as the degradation of ISIS, this is a long time in the making. Down in Syria, there's still, the leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, is still a wanted man. He's sort of the new Osama bin Laden. There's a $25 million bounty on his head that the U.S. will pay out for any information leading to his capture. We just don't know where he is. And that's another thing, in order to claim victory to an organization like this, there's something at least symbolic about the killing or capturing of the senior leader. And just like it took 10 years to finally eliminate bin Laden, who was hiding out in Pakistan, it may take several years to finally find al-Baghdadi. But I think it's a necessary conclusion. Otherwise, these followers, it's sort of a recruitment tool. Look, we can outsmart the U.S. We can outsmart the West. We're just one man. They can't even find us, type thing.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about how this works. We would get the fall of Raqqa and so forth, major accomplishments reported in our news, the smaller day-to-day operations, not so much. Talk a little bit more about the cooperation militarily that happened in the last few years to go after ISIS.
Yes. When it comes to Syria, what you have is the U.S. and our allies, largely our NATO allies, Australia, New Zealand, Great Britain, France, and others. On the one side, this is really the eastern portion of the Euphrates River. On the west, you have Syria aligned with Russia, aligned with Iran, targeting anti-Assad rebel groups. Some of these may be Daesh or ISIS. Some of them may be al-Qaeda, but largely it's these sort of just rebel groups. In some cases, they're U.S.-backed rebel groups. So on the one side, they're bombing. On the other side, the U.S. and its allies are bombing. Sometimes they're both bombing the same terrorist targets. A lot of times they're not. And the thing to be, I think, apprehensive about here is we're getting into smaller and smaller territories around Deir al-Zor province, is that these are fighters and bombers and drones all flying around in increasingly small areas, all being controlled by different parties. The Russians have their aircraft, the Iranians have their aircraft doing sorties, and so does the U.S. And they're not, there's no way to communicate. If you're an air traffic controller for the Air Force, let's say, you're talking to the Air Force pilots, the U.S. Air Force pilots. There's no way to deconflict directly with the Russian or Iranian or Syrian Air Force. Now, they're trying to mitigate that through a third party out of Iraq. But my point here is that it's, you know, it's the risk for error or miscalculation is very real.
Mm-hmm. And so you've got an intent, and history tells us, doesn't it, that you can have these sorts of situations, and you know, unintentional or not, you can have a tripwire there that can set off a series of events.
Absolutely. I mean, let's not forget Gulf of Tonkin. This was just we know now.
The start of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, and we know now it was based on a terrible error and a miscalculation really on both sides. And that is the risk when you're flying all of these air missions in such a confined area.
Mm-hmm. Evan Renfro is with us, former Air Force intelligence analyst, also drawing on his political expertise, his assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Mary. Mary is in Iowa City. Hi, Mary. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. Is my radio feeding back to you?
Yeah, please turn it down a bit, Mary. Thank
okay.
you. Welcome to the program. What's your question? Okay. Mary's getting to her radio. Hi, Mary. Are you back with us?
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. My question is, what role does colonization have in this spectacular world of ISIS? It seems like ever since the 19th century, the West has been in the Middle East. And Basevich has a very good book about this. But ISIS is not dead. It's going to morph.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mary, great question, because this does, you know, a lot of the borders, Evan, right, they have to do with they were former colonies. They were colonial powers, made some of these states here, not necessarily paying attention to ethnic groups and religious groups, right?
Absolutely. This is Lawrence of Arabia stuff. This is that World War I time frame where they come out with Sykes-Picot and actually draw the borders of Iraq and Syria. And it's funny that, I mean, I don't know if funny is not the right word, but I was just listening to an officer of Daesh lecturing about Sykes-Picot to his ISIS colleagues. So for many Americans, this might be sort of ancient history. For them, this stuff out of 1919, 1920 is real. And they hate it. They think these borders are artificial or are colonial drawn. And, of course, they were drawn by colonial powers. So they're not wrong to that extent.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about the defeat of ISIS, the Islamic State, in quotation marks, that defeat, as we, and I think Mary had this point also to make, is we've been hearing a lot of, you know, rhetoric from this administration talking about the great defeat. How do you view that with your analyst mind and your background there? Do you think that is connected or somewhat disconnected from the reality?
Well, I mean, look, the fact of the matter is, ISIS, as we know it, has been virtually entirely pushed out of Iraq. The fact of the matter is, ISIS, as we know it, has been reduced to an enormous extent in Syria. Now, that does not mean that terrorism, as you know, I said last time I was on the show, it's not going to be rainbows and unicorns from now on. You know, from now on, there will continue to be some sort of terrorism, whether that's going to be ISIS or Al-Qaeda or something entirely new. You know, 15 years ago, we had never heard of ISIS. Mm-hmm. So until you have civil society in that area, that is to say a strong and stable and respected and competent and uncorrupt central government in these states, you're going to have these sorts of conflicts.
Caller wondering, just leaving a message about all the different usage. You said Daesh, we have IS or ISIS, we also have ISIL, the Islamic State in the Levant. These are all the same thing. We never really settled on one title, did we?
Sure, and I can explain this. So Daesh is the Arabic acronym for what we call ISIS, right? Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. During the Obama administration, they preferred ISIL, which was the Islamic State in Iraq and Levant. Levant is just a translation of the Arabic word al-Sham, which is just the region, this Levantine Mediterranean area there of Palestine, Syria, and so forth. I go with Daesh. That's what everyone in the Middle East calls it. That's many of our NATO allies have taken to calling it Daesh. And, you know, what I like about it is it really infuriates the terrorists that belong to this group, because that word sounds like it's a cognate of a verb in Arabic that means to stomp on with one's foot. And so the penalty, actually, if Daesh was to hear you say that in Raqqa, back when they owned Raqqa, the first offense penalty was to cut out your tongue. Mm. So I say that with solidarity and some pride.
Mm. Coming up on a break in a minute or two, but in your eyes, how successful has Donald Trump been in fighting ISIS? That much different than Barack Obama?
Well, different on two standpoints. One is the intensity of the number of airstrikes. The military force being used is of greater intensity in the last year than it was before. The other, I think the corollary to this, is the delegation of authority to military officers.
Mm-hmm.
That's been well documented now. He's delegated to Mattis, Secretary of Defense Mattis, who's delegated to General Vattel of Central Command, who has delegated on down the ranks. It used to sort of be White House played more of a role in these decisions. So those two decisions equate to, I think, military victory as far as we're defining it in its limited sense. Again,
did that ramping up create more civilian casualties?
It certainly did. So that's one of the downsides here. Purely as a matter of physics, the more airstrikes you do in the same given area, unfortunately, collateral damage is going to go up. And there's absolutely been well-documented reports of increased collateral damage. So you do have this, from a military perspective only, this tactical level or operational level success story. However, on the strategic level, the big picture stuff, that's where the worry comes in, because you can have you can win the battles and lose the war. And I think without the humanitarian side, without the diplomatic side, which emanates from the State Department, which has been really hollowed out in the last year, you're going to have these strategic problems long term.
Okay, we want to ask you about that, exactly a point to leave at and pick up with in our second half hour. Evan Renfro, I want to ask you about the State Department. Something like, 30% cuts, many, many positions eliminated there. Ask Evan Renfro how military tactics go hand in hand with diplomacy and how this president is approaching that differently, evidently. We can see in the budget cuts. Former Air Force intelligence analyst Evan Renfro in our Cedar Falls studio. He's now on the faculty at the University of Northern Iowa in the Department of Political Science. We'd like to hear from you this hour. If you have questions about not only ISIS, but other extremist groups, talk about some of his other areas of expertise. He focused on understanding foreign leaders' personalities. Maybe we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Evan Renfro is with us. I'm Ben Kiefer. More of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Here's an important point for anybody who was planning on going to Pints and Politics. We had an event with the Gazette, Iowa Public Radio, and the Gazette presenting Pints and Politics, recorded before a live audience in Cedar Rapids tonight. That event has been postponed, I just heard. So don't show up. Stay off these roads. Fairly unsafe, of course, with this winter storm. We'll be postponing that until January 25th. That's Thursday, 2 weeks from today. So put that on your calendar. Register for free at thegazette.com/pintsandpolitics. Evan Renfro with us, former Air Force intelligence analyst, 4 years of active duty, now assistant professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Fascinating conversation about the so-called defeat of ISIS. We'll see what happens in the months and years to come to an organization, a terrorist organization that had its sights set on restoring a caliphate. We'll be talking about that in the first half hour. Talk about a few other things here. We left off with the State Department. What is your view of the drastic cuts to the State Department and the U.S. diplomatic corps? Evan Renfro. I've heard both sides of this, just sort of, you know, our Secretary of State saying this is a necessary streamlining. We're just getting things done in a more efficient, less costly manner. Can you see it that way?
Well, no. I'm afraid that in contradistinction to the military victories, I think the strategic consequences of this hollowing out of State Department are going to be with us for some time. This goes back really to General Petraeus's counterinsurgency manual that he wrote in the aftermath of 9/11, trying to figure out what can we do better so that these sort of things don't happen again. One of the points he made in that manual, that U.S. Army and Marine Corps field manual for counterinsurgency, was that, look, we have more people in the Army band than we have as Foreign Service officers in the State Department. Well, now you have even fewer Foreign Service officers at the State Department. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who I like, he's a fellow Texan from University of Texas at Austin, just like me, so he can't be all bad. But he's come in saying he wants a 30% reduction. And so far, he's got about 20% of a drop. Half of the career ministers, these are your 3- and 4-star general level Foreign Service officers, are out.
What are the repercussions? But also in the future would be the...
you have a void of leadership at the top of State Department, and with that is going to come a bureaucracy adrift with no direction. And one of the consequences that really bothers me as a professor is there's a 50% drop in college students that have taken the Foreign Service Officer exam.
50% drop.
And I've had actually some of my brightest students come up to me and say, yeah, you know, they were planning on taking it. They are well aware of what's going on from reading the paper, and they've just lost interest. And apparently this is nationwide. So That, when you see a 50% drop in college students taking this infamously difficult civil service exam for Foreign Service officers, that is when you know you have a problem on your hands that might take a generation to recover from.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. A few more words about Yemen, the Republic of Yemen. This is a very poor Arab country in the southern end of the Arabian Peninsula. Saudi Arabia to the north. Bordered also by water, but the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden. It's an ally of the U.S., and now this is a place where ISIS is looking or has camps. We look to Yemen as a place where they'll say, okay, they don't have a strong control of their own country, so this is an ideal place to nest.
That's right. And al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is already thriving. And this is what happens when you have chaos, when you have that lack of central government I keep mentioning. Is the consequence here is breeding ground for terrorism. We have indeed tripled the number of airstrikes because we were hesitant to get involved at all with Yemen. That was one of the things when President Trump first came into office. He ordered that SEAL raid that turned out to not come off successfully, and SEAL died and so forth. And so there has been a hesitation. Obama was hesitant when he was president to get heavily involved. But now we're really upping those airstrikes because I think the writing's on the wall that, you know, if we don't do something, we're sort of just letting the problem metastasize.
Okay, drawing a line to cancer or something like that. What is at stake for the U.S.? You know, why do we care if there's chaos in a country on the other side of the world?
Great question. I would just point to September 2001. There was a little chaotic, poor country that nobody cared about called Afghanistan. And when you allow a terrorist adversary to have a safe haven to do their training and planning, this is the sort of stuff that happens, potentially.
Right.
That's the concern.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we would care about what happens in poor little Yemen.
Right, and in dire straits, the population, most of the population, you just have to look at the pictures, emaciated people. This is a huge humanitarian crisis.
That's correct, and it's a humanitarian crisis with no end in sight. That's just getting worse. I mean, I think it's almost impossible for aid workers to do anything because they get killed. And again, it's just the U.S. looks at this and say, hey, we already intervened and occupied Iraq, and that turned into a mess. We intervened and didn't occupy in Libya, and that turned into a mess. We neither intervened in any serious way or occupied in Yemen, and that's a mess. So what's the strategy here that we're supposed to do? As you can see, it's a pretty complex problem.
Okay, so what is the best that we can hope for from the perspective of the United States?
Yeah, so I'm a big advocate of this idea of counterterrorism rather than counterinsurgency. This is sort of what Biden the Biden side of the White House tried to convince, according to Bob Woodward and others, tried to convince President Obama, and President Obama sort of split the differences. Counterinsurgency is more akin to nation building. This is trying to set up schools, dig wells, and so forth. And I can tell you, in Iraq and Afghanistan, you can build a school, and the bad guys are going to come blow that school up. You can build a well, the bad guys come and build the well up. Counterterrorism, on the other hand, is bad guy elimination. This is drones. Now, we have drones, the technological progress there. You can have far fewer boots on the ground. You have special operators doing what they do. You can think of it more like a law enforcement action rather than this heavy invasive presence of an occupying force.
Well, that goes back to 9/11. When you say police action, that would have been an alternative way to respond to 9/11, would it not have been?
It would have been.
And we will never know how that would
right.
have turned out.
Yeah, that's one of these counterintuitive things. I think with the Taliban in charge of Afghanistan, look, the Taliban had to be overthrown, right? Because they were refusing. You know, President Bush gave them that offer. He said, turn over the senior al-Qaeda leadership, and maybe you'll survive this. The Taliban was not interested in taking that deal. Mm-hmm. As a result, they were overthrown. So I think insofar as what had occurred in Afghanistan was probably necessary. Mm-hmm. Iraq, on the other hand, was, even though a dictator and a tyrant, it was indeed a stable dictatorship. In other words, while it's no fun to be an Iraqi citizen, under Saddam Hussein, you did not have a breeding ground for terrorism because the Mukhabarat, the secret police, would come to your house and kill you.
Evan Renfro, my guest, former Air Force intelligence analyst, now at the University of Northern Iowa in the political science department. I'm really eager to talk about, intelligence analyst just has this James Bond ring about it. I'm sure it wasn't that romantic.
No, far from. Maybe that's what I thought when I signed up for it, but far from. Rather than that secret agent stuff, it's more like being a college professor, really. It's reading, reading, and more reading, and critical thinking. Look, and dealing with facts as they are, not the way you want them to be, mm-hmm. and the ability to speak truth to power. I mean, there are bosses in the world, generals, and political leaders and so forth that oftentimes may not want to hear from intelligence sources, from the intelligence community. You know, we have a motto that says intelligence, ignored in peacetime, blamed in war. Mm. And this is one of the things that you always have to struggle with. And you hope that you have leadership that is responsive to facts as presented by the intelligence community, whose bread and butter is simply facts, not the way we want them.
Right.
The way they are.
We mentioned Vietnam, Gulf of Tonkin in this over the last few decades. In your opinion, are we straying from that? Are we making more decisions based on politics than on good, neutral, solid intelligence? Do you see that danger?
What I see a danger is when you start vilifying civil servants, whether that's in the State Department or the intelligence community. These are institutions that have been around and have made mistakes, but by and large have provided a stable and stabilizing framework from which political leadership can then operate. For whatever that political leadership may want to do, the intelligence community doesn't make policy. We're very careful on that. What the intelligence community tries to do is give policymakers information that is factually correct.
Right. And you did research. You briefed four-star generals. Can you give us an instance of under what circumstances?
Yeah. So, well, I got to be a little bit careful here, but let me see if I can do this in a broad way. Well, so when I was the subject matter expert for countering weapons of mass destruction in the Asia-Pacific area of operations, we'd have the general come by and, you know, you brief them once a week on what's going on. And, you know, I love briefing generals. You know, the higher grade you're dealing with, the better, or the easier it is to brief these folks because they know what you're trying to do from a strategic overview. I think it's harder to brief people maybe that are new to the game of strategy and war, and they want to hear what they want to hear. Generals usually have been around long enough to know that their intelligence assets are trying to give them the best advice they can.
I understand you also looked into one of your focuses was to analyze heads of state. sort of understanding their personalities? Who did you look at in that setup?
Yeah, so we always want to understand what we call behavioral analysis and human factors. So you would want to have these dossiers, psychological profiles built around any sort of decision makers from both adversary countries and friendly countries, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
You would want to know who has what sort of habits, lifestyle habits. You would want to know if somebody has a gambling problem, if someone has an addiction problem. And because these are influencers that allow them to be influenced for better or worse. We say mice. Money, ideology, compromise, and ego are the reasons how, you know, you can sort of work decision makers, adversary decision makers, or even ally decision makers, and have these folks do policy-wise what you need them to do. Now, most leaders don't have these sorts of problems. Most leaders are just, you know, many leaders at least are normal folks with big egos, however. And so the smart thing to do is always be nice and don't be confrontational, but understand who you're dealing with and what motivates them.
Mm-hmm. We have a huge, I mean, imagine if we're doing this with other countries are at least to some degree doing it with our leaders. We have a huge contrast between Barack Obama and Donald Trump here, if we would analyze leaders.
But yes, indeed. And I can assure you that our adversaries are working very hard to gather all the same sort of intelligence that we do.
Mm-hmm. What about Vladimir Putin?
Well, Vladimir Putin is an autocrat who's responsible for the murder of countless journalists, political opponents. He's a despot. You don't know much about his personal life because they don't have a free press. There's nobody to ask his ex-wife or his kids any questions because they'd be thrown in jail or worse. Putin is somebody that is obviously power hungry. He comes from being a mid-level Kremlin KGB officer. He's a lieutenant colonel, retired out of the KGB. And wants the rise, the rise of Russia again. He wants Russia to be a big player.
Can you buy into in any way the idea? I mean, put forth by this administration, by Donald Trump, but also people like his former advisors, Carter Page, that we're really seeing Russia wrong. We would do better to have a much closer alliance and not see them through this sort of enemy lens all the time.
I think that's certainly what Putin would like us to do. I mean, I think that is a grossly naive, if not infantile, perspective on the situation.
Mm, why?
Well, because Putin, we know what Putin's goals are. He doesn't make this mysterious. He's not a subtle man. His goal is, and this is a zero-sum game, he sees the world as zero-sum, and basically he sees this as the bear versus the whale, you know, Russia versus the U.S. So any trouble he can make for us, and we're seeing that play out in Syria, any trouble he can make for us, he's going to do. We see this in the annexation of Crimea. He's destabilizing the post-World War II order that the U.S. has led since 1945, but even more so since the end of the Cold War, when we became the sole superpower and the Soviet Union dissolved.
Mm-hmm. But even bigger than that, than Russia versus the U.S., this is autocracy versus democracy. He's trying to undermine not only ours, but many of our allies' democracies.
This is what he would consider Western democratic norms. This liberal order, the idea of civil society, the idea of free and fair elections are anathema to him. He's a strong man. He's a bully. And he's been successful. So you can give him credit on that.
Mm-hmm. Can't we, though, get some benefit with better cooperation with Russia? Or is it sort of a la carte? You have to pick and choose.
I can't think of a benefit that has happened. I suppose anything's possible. You could somehow make a deal. We've tried that to no avail in Syria. So the only examples I can give you would be where we have not had any benefit of a relationship with Russia.
For instance?
Well, for instance, Syria.
Yeah.
And for instance, the pushback to NATO. So we've attempted time and again to have NATO exercises, whereas Putin will order his armored divisions right on the border with our Baltic state allies, very threatening. And it's not always clear if Article 5 of NATO, which says an attack on one member state shall be treated as an attack on all, it's not always clear that that will be enforced. But we haven't had to test that yet. You know.
Do you think the Baltic states will be tested? Do you think you will do sort of a Crimea move to get back those three Baltic states?
My assessment is that there is a plan on the shelf for him to execute that someday. It would take about 12 hours for those Russian armored divisions to completely occupy the Baltic states.
NATO has nowhere near the force to stop that.
Not in the first 12 hours, 24 hours, 48 hours. This would be a total victory. And then once all that armor is in and the air defenses are set up, it becomes increasingly hard to kick them out. So I'm not saying that will happen. I'm saying that.
But you also have the same excuses in Crimea, in Ukraine, that you have a Russian population, ethnic Russian population there, right?
That's the argument that Putin was using. He said, look, these folks in Crimea, they like Russia. They speak Russian, many of them. We even had an election, and 99.8% of them voted that they wanted to be Russia. And sure, I mean, that's the argument. He also said that there was no Russian troops involved. I mean, these things we know to be manifestly untrue.
Mm. Wow. We have just a few more minutes. I'd like this to go on for hours. Evan, I hope we'll have you back to talk about your area of expertise here in this area. But I want to get your answer to this question, 9/11. Many young people running around who don't really have that in their living memory anymore. It's hard to fathom that. But do you think there could be another successful attack in the U.S. like 9/11, or perhaps even worse?
Yeah, yes, I do. That is always a potential. I remember I was just a young Air Force airman at the time, getting a cup of coffee, and saw that happen. We were sure what it was straight away. But you're right, it is strange teaching young people in the classroom today that are college age that really don't have that sort of memory. I suppose it's like our grandparents and parents with Pearl Harbor. We really don't have that sort of same memory frame. I think intelligence has to win every day against terrorism. The terrorist only has to win once. We've made it a heck of a lot harder to do these sort of catastrophic 9/11 type terror attacks that Al-Qaeda like to do. That's another difference between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. ISIS is big on these lone wolf attacks. These lone wolf attacks are a problem for the U.S. because unless you want to live in just a complete dictatorship, it's in, a complete police state, it's just not possible to prevent 100% of these sorts of lone wolf attacks. If you go to your kitchen and get a steak knife and go out and attack somebody, how is intelligence or law enforcement supposed to stop that?
Mm-hmm. Back to the Middle East, where we started here, the recognition of Israel as Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, with the intention of moving the U.S. embassy there. This decision by the Trump administration, repercussions, has that changed the equation? Complicated and already complicated Middle East tension.
Well, this is one of those things. I have to admit, I was wrong, at least so far, and I'm glad to be wrong on this. I thought when that decision was announced, I thought on Friday, when everybody goes to mosque, that's their holy day, that all these Palestinians and their neighbors would be furious and up in arms, and they were going to do the third intifada. That would not have surprised me at all. However, that really didn't happen. You certainly had protests and pushback politically. Even at the UN, you had this overwhelming vote against this idea. But you haven't seen the massive violence that I and others were expecting.
Why not?
For now, my assessment there is pure resignation of the majority of the Palestinian people are just have nothing left to offer. I think
Donald Trump was right. He's just stating what was already existing as far as the U.S. position siding with Israel.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's clear that the U.S. always sides with Israel. It's just it overturns all those decades of policy with not overtly saying, Jerusalem is going to be the capital of Israel.
But we wanted to be. We said, at least, we were the neutral mediator
right.
Here. And that dashed that, right?
Right.
Completely.
In
everyone's eyes, not just in the Palestinians' eyes.
Right. I mean, I suppose, we've been completely balanced towards our foreign policy tilted to the benefit of Israel for decades, really since 1948. And I suppose with President Trump just saying out loud what everybody already knew, maybe wasn't such a surprise, and it didn't make people as furious as many of us thought they would.
Okay, Evan, we've run out of time. Fascinating hour. Thanks for sharing some of your earlier career and your political science now at the University of Northern Iowa. Evan Renfro with us in our Cedar Falls studio. Thanks, Evan.
We'll talk
to you again soon.
Thanks.
Once again, Pints in Politics to be this evening at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. I was going to be there along with many from the Gazette. Has been postponed until January 25th. That is 2 weeks from today because, of course, the winter storm. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Stay warm and stay safe. And if possible, stay off the roads.